where Dave and I plan this year's company holidays.
Let's go through the list.
Easter, too religious.
St. Patrick's Day?
Too white. Mother's Day?
Way too cisgendered.
All of your usual holidays have been canceled this year.
But we still have Karl Marx's birthday! Ha
ha! Need a real reason to party? Find a new job at redballoon.work.
I'm talking about Canadian physicians and nurses too. They think actually that they're doing good. And so unless they decide to go back to old-fashioned medicine, doctor-patient relationship, putting the patient first, examining the data for yourself, looking at alternative views, looking at skeptical views about science, which is how science progresses, unless they do all these things, I don't think that waking up that you talk about is going to happen.
Hey everybody, Michael Thiessen here, and today I am speaking with Dr. Francis Christian. And folks, I normally don't go ahead and read through one of our guests' bios. It's just one of those things I've avoided because it takes so much time. But based upon the conversation I'm about to have with Dr. Francis Christian, I want to read his bio for you before we get the conversation started. So here it is. Dr. Francis Christian was clinical professor of surgery at the University of Saskatchewan, the director of quality improvement and patient care safety, and the founder and director of the Surgical Humanities Program. Along with that, he was a founding editor-in-chief of the Journal of the Surgical Humanities. Dr. Francis, thank you so much for being with us. It's great to have you on the show. We are going to talk about the irony of all of your experience and your expertise in the face of getting fired for speaking up against the COVID-19 narrative. Thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks you. Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Michael. It's a privilege to be here.
So, Francis, would you be willing to just share, you know, as time passes, people quickly forget what we've been through. Would you take us back to, you know, your story and the first time some of us from the other parts of Canada would have heard about this professor in Saskatchewan who is being fired?
Absolutely. I can definitely take you back through those months. You would recall, Michael, and your viewers would recall that the pandemic was declared in March of 2020. At that time, I actually gave the government, the authorities, a little bit of a long rope. I said, you know, this is supposed to be a new virus. Let's see what happens, and let's give them a bit of a chance to put this whole thing under control. So at that time, there were these massive lockdowns. There was a lot of TV propaganda going on. And by the end of April, beginning of March, I started looking at the totality of what's going on, and I detected a few things. One of the things I detected was that the media was coordinating a message which was really a message of fear. And afterwards, it turned out actually that the British, there was a unit created by the government, in fact, to inculcate fear in the population. And I had actually studied the Soviet Union in quite a lot of detail. And the reason for that, Michael, is because as a teenager, I read a book which had a great impact and influence on my life. And that was by Richard Wurmbrand. It's called Tortured for Christ. And I thought I thought to myself at that time, when I was a teenager, I thought to myself, I should take every effort to know in very great detail how the Soviets exerted this amount of control over the population. And so I've been a student of Soviet history, and to a lesser degree, but also quite a lot of detail of Nazi Germany's history. And I started recognizing certain patterns. And one of the patterns was the control of the media, and which became an arm of government. The media was not independent. It wasn't giving any kind of nuance. It wasn't giving any kind of alternative views, because even at that time, there were several experts who were questioning the narrative. And then they started deplatforming people. People I knew about even before COVID. So as a trauma surgeon, I often worked, for example, with the ICU guys. And there were people like Paul Marrick, who I had heard about even before COVID, because his work on sepsis is actually seminal in ICU care. Similarly, there's a fellow called Pierre Corey, and he's another ICU physician. He wrote the definitive book on point-of-care ultrasound, and I knew about that book and about him before the COVID pandemic. And these were the guys being censored. So there was censorship going on, deplatforming of these experts going on. And then there were these terms that came on, misinformation, disinformation. It was right out of the Soviet playbook. They actually used those terms very frequently. And they would say, you know, so-and-so has been guilty of disinformation has therefore been arrested and so on. So at that time, and this was May of 2020, I started looking at the data, actual raw data, and none of it made sense compared to the narrative. And so I started discussing this with my colleagues, with my residents, with the medical students. You must remember that as a surgeon, anesthesiologists and surgeons work very closely together. And many anesthesiologists actually double up as ICU physicians. And I started asking them some of the things that they were doing. We were all working in this together. I was looking after patients who had a diagnosis of COVID, except that I was doing surgery on them. I was, you know, very much an active surgeon at that time. And so what I found was that it wasn't actually making any kind of headway, my discussion of the actual data. There was a sort of a glaze that would come over people's eyes if I actually confronted them with actual data. And so that wasn't making much headway. I tried within the system to try and change it. And then in 2021, early 2021, the government started rolling out this vaccine to our kids. The kids, as you know, Michael, healthy kids don't need it. They don't. And even at that time, the data was very clear. The fact that in fact COVID had a 3,000 time difference in mortality between the elderly and between the young was being hid from the public. So that was a very essential part of the public information, that there was more than a 3,000-fold higher mortality in the elderly compared to the young. And that is an essential thing that was being hid. Even at that time, reports of myocarditis was coming out. And we knew that there were some basic problems with the Pfizer vaccine and with the mRNA technology and platform. And we knew also that this technology had never been tried clinically like this in humans ever before. So at that time, I decided that I had to speak out, and I had to speak up for the kids, because our children don't have a voice, and we have to be their voice. And so I decided that I would have a press conference. And the press conference, in the press conference, I actually was very clear that I wasn't speaking for the university. I wasn't speaking for the government. I was speaking as a father and as a recent grandfather and as a surgeon and physician. And what I said in that statement, and if people go to the JCCF website, they can actually find my statement in full. What I was saying is actually very simple, that informed consent, full informed consent, wasn't being given to our kids and our parents. That was a press conference that was attended by the press, reported by the press, and the next week I was fired from my positions as director of patient safety and quality improvement. I was fired from my director of surgical humanities. One would have thought that the humanities, with this human story, the narrative of human disease and suffering, would have had even more importance in this pandemic. But anyway, they fired me from that. I was suspended from my university appointment, and I was forbidden from having contact with medical students and residents, because in some way, my asking for informed consent was supposed to be dangerous to them. So that was where that happened. And so the fact is that emergency for our kids has not gone away. There is still a health emergency, and that is that our kids, as young as 6 months old, are being given, offered, coerced sometimes, to get a injection, which they don't need. Healthy kids don't need it, and which can actually kill them. So I would urge parents, if you're listening to this, you don't need to give this vaccine to your kids, and don't feel guilty about it. There's a whole lot of data that backs your decision if you don't decide to give this injection, mRNA injection, to the kids.
So, Dr. Christian, I'm going to ask a very, maybe I want to say end user or patient question. You were teaching at the university and you were also performing surgery at the hospital. What type of surgeries were you performing?
Well, your viewers should know that from March of this year, I'm retired from surgery.
Yes.
But up to that time, and up to the time I was fired, I was a general surgeon, which means things like cancer surgery, thyroid surgery. I was also a trauma surgeon, looked after things like gunshot wounds, knife wounds, motor vehicle accidents, things like that. Yeah.
The reason why I asked the question is because I'm a father of four. One of my children has had surgery to remove cancer from his liver. He had a growth on his liver. He had childhood hepatoblastoma. Okay. I have another child who has a mild version of spina bifida and has, of course, in her infancy, had to have her back operated on and the opening closed. And never in my mind as a father, if I were sitting back in your community and you got up and said something about vaccination as a surgeon, two things are never going to happen in my mind. The first thing that's never going to happen is I'm never going to dismiss you quickly, because you're another form of second opinion. Like, the medical community has lots of opinions. I know what it's like for doctors to argue about things. I'm glad to have a second opinion. But what's definitely not going to happen, and my viewers, I'm spending some time on this with Dr. Christian because you need to hear this clearly. I am definitely not going to release a surgeon from employment who would be having the skills to cut open individuals, to sew them back up, to heal them, because of his view of vaccinations and because he wants to be a little bit cautious with my children. The two are not equated. You know, the things that a regulatory body might dismiss a surgeon about would be what? Using unsterile equipment knowingly, having a number of complaints about surgeries that had gone poorly. This is not even in the category of discipline for your actual profession.
Yes. It's interesting you bring that up, Michael. As part of my job performance reviews, I actually had excellent job performance reviews. In fact, my boss told me in 2018 that if he could give me a bonus, he would. My job performance reviews were excellent and had no problems with it at all. In addition, I introduced to the Department of Surgery a program called the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program. It's based in Chicago at the American College of Surgeons. And before I actually brought it to Saskatchewan, nobody had heard anything about it. And I brought it, and my chief at the time, actually, I give him credit, that he actually saw the value of the program. So I'm very well versed with data analysis too. In addition, I collaborated with the computer department here in the development of an app for iPhone and Android. It's called the M&M, or Morbidity and Mortality app. As far as I know, it's still being used throughout Saskatchewan for morbidity and mortality. In other words, It's a tool for quality improvement. So you're right. By the grace of God, I had absolutely no problems with my work as a surgeon or director of quality improvement, patient safety. And I co-founded the Department of Surgical Humanities. The flagship journal of that department was the Journal of the Surgical Humanities, which now has a worldwide circulation. I was the founding editor of that. Now, why the surgical humanities? It's essentially to introduce and engage physicians, medical students, residents with things like poetry, drama, narrative, music, and so on, because you can't really treat the human being without knowing the human story. And how do you know the human narrative and the human story, the human suffering, for example? It is by an engagement with the humanities. So I co-founded that department too, and they thought that I should be fired from that too for reasons I still don't understand.
I just am pausing on this topic so heavily because I think of the medical, I think of medical professions who are around me, medical professionals who are around me, who would be skeptical of looking too far outside of the narrative for the fear of finding that they've, you know, just haphazardly gone along with such a drug push. But it overwhelms me to think that our healthcare is actually being totally overrun with a lack of dialogue and data analysis. At the same time, letting someone go. Like I have children who need your exact expertise. I have two children who in the past, if we were living in Saskatchewan, very much could have been under your surgical care. And you were fired for holding a press conference for disagreeing with the health department. And we've seen this across our country, and it is just it just causes me so much anger. And I'm pausing on it because I just I'm actually got a few medical professionals in the back of my mind, and I really want you guys to hear the type of man that was released for holding one press conference. And first of all, Dr. Francis, I just want to thank you for taking a stand and speaking up for the children. The second thing I want everybody to listen to carefully is how we got here. So the first part of the podcast, I said, tell me the story. And you started with a fairly long explanation of your research. And it's interesting for people to hear that. They need to hear that because history is such an important tool for us. And you know, interestingly enough, you and I both were kind of at the same time going through a real investigation of the Soviet Union and communism and that history. And it's true. You know, you hear within the Christian community, you can hear the same dialogue happening today between the Christians and the government, between the Christians who want to say, hey, you know what, we've got to stop and take a stand here, and those who are saying, no, the government hasn't gone far enough. And it's literally the same dialogue. And when you talked about the use of the of misinformation and the use of terms like disinformation, our prime minister is using those terms now virtually with every press conference. And in fact, the pro-life movement has been completely categorized as a movement of misinformation. And it's absurd, but it's the same absurdity that's been applied now to general medicine. I have a question for you, Dr. Francis, because this is something I'm really struggling with. And here it is. How does someone like me, someone like yourself, go back into the medical community with any level of trust? Is it just on this area of COVID-19 where they're going to go, no, whatever I'm told, just do it. I don't want to pay the same price as Dr. Christian. I don't want to face that price. And then everything else they're going to do is going to be normal, back to normal medicine. Like, how do we re-engage the medical community? You talked about data analysis. I don't trust doctors to analyze anything anymore. And maybe I'm overreacting. Help our listeners navigate those feelings.
And you're not alone by any means, Michael. A large section of the public has lost complete confidence in the medical profession. This is one of the tragedies of this pandemic. And it'll take several decades before that trust is recovered. I have to say that my colleagues, I think nurses, for some reason, are more willing, even in Canada, to speak out and speak up for the patient. Remember, we as physicians and nurses should not put public health first, should not put the Pfizer company or any companies first, or public health policy or the government first. Our duty is to put the patient first. And putting the patient first is something that I think more nurses have been doing that than physicians, frankly. And only a very small minority of physicians, or nurses for that matter, have been willing to actually examine the data. When we practice surgery, for example, and let's say I did a lot of thyroid surgery and thyroid cancer surgery, and I would never operate based on somebody, one person or one authority telling me what to do or how to operate. I would look at opposing views. I would look at different ways of doing the surgery, different approaches, different data sets and so on. And that's the way I make a decision. That's the way I hope every physician makes the decision based on everything. But that's been thrown completely out of the window in this pandemic. And partly it's because there was a lot of intimidation and attempts at intimidation by government bodies, by College of Physicians, Surgeons, American boards, and so on. But there is a old, but it's old, but forever new. Verse in the Gospel according to Mark, where Jesus says, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but loses his own soul?" So, the soul of the medical profession, I'm afraid it's being lost because of the fact that physicians and nurses have chosen silence and have chosen to ignore what they're seeing in the data and in patients. And it's, you know, before it's too late, my appeal even now would be, physicians and surgeons, if you have felt that you should speak up and speak out, now's the time to do it. Tomorrow may be too late.
It's very interesting that you utilize that verse and applied it in that way. Because as you were talking about it, I had the thought, you know, first of all, that was the story and the teaching of Christ that actually turned my life around. I was, as a young man, longing to gain the whole world. And it was that verse in the Gospels that said, well, what does that profit you? What do you gain if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? And so that was actually, I remember being 19 years old, and that was one of the verses that the Lord used to have me repent of my sin and to rededicate my life to the Lord. But then you went and applied it to the medical community, and I think that's also a very apt application. This is not just a, it's analogous, like the primary application of that is for the individual to not gain their whole world, reject Christ and be damned to hell. And like, it's a matter of salvation, but that same type of principle is applied in areas where what does it profit me if the thing I'm doing is absolutely gutted of all virtue and righteousness and goodness and has no soul to it. I really appreciate you making that analogy, making that comparison, because that's exactly what I think many people have felt. Even when you have doctors say to you, I know, you know, we felt that the same thing with pastoring. You know, a pastor who would say, I know the church should be open, but I'm not sure, or but, and an excuse. They've lost the soul of pastoring. And it's true, you know, these medical professionals must be reeling inside with now participating in a system that is, you know, veering drastically away with what they signed up to do. You know, there's a vast difference between signing up to be a surgeon and helping people surgically and then injecting young children with an experimental vaccine that has ignored virtually every safety protocol and process that we've had. Okay, I have another question for you, because either, you know, as we talk, you know, I like to ask these questions that only you can answer, Dr. Christian. So here's the question. How is it that you can be terminated from virtually every position so quickly? Like, is there not a disciplinary process? Is there not a warning process? Is there not, I assume you were terminated with cause, not just without cause, unless they did do that. How is it that there was zero dialogue? And there's a double-sided question. Number one, like kind of the practical side of, man, it seemed like it happened so quickly. Was there no actual due process? But then the flip side of it is, do you have any inclination as to why the university would act so swiftly? Like, have you heard that there was pressure coming in from the government, or why was it such a, you know, just a come in and catch you up and take you away type of reaction?
I have no idea why they acted in the way they did. I think it's extraordinary the way they acted. It was, I don't know whether that's ever been done before, but I would very much doubt it. In my view, it is unprecedented, this sort of behavior from the authorities. As far as my contract was concerned, as almost every contract nowadays, there is a clause, or there are clauses in every contract that do permit firing without cause, so without any reason whatsoever. But all this is part of a lawsuit that the GCCF has launched on my behalf, and so whilst those technical matters are with the courts, it's not that I cannot comment about it, but it's going to be revealed in court proceedings.
Well, I look forward to reading those proceedings, and certainly in the future, if you want to come back on, and feel free to even read the transcripts for us. So many people just need that firsthand information to realize how tragic the situation really is. And that's totally fine. I think for my listeners, I just really wanted them to have the opportunity to, again, pause on an important point. And that is, you got up and had one interview. I'm also thinking in the back of my mind of a doctor in Barrie. Her name's Crystal Lechkew. Dr. Crystal, yes. Lechkew. She did one interview with me on this podcast, and she has now been suspended. And I know that it is the transcripts from the podcast that they're utilizing against her. And so we are talking about, such a drastic and such I want to say maximum penalty for you, and all you were doing was giving a second opinion and presenting the data.
Absolutely. And so I can tell you about the lawsuit and why I'm fighting this.
That would be great. Go ahead. I'm sure my listeners would like to hear that.
Yeah. The lawsuit actually has three parts. One is violating my academic freedom. It's not enough for a university to give lip service to academic freedom, but that's been clearly violated in my case. Academic freedom and freedom itself, as we understand it in many countries, it has been developed over several years, several centuries. I call that a product of our Christian civilization, not a Western civilization, because if the influence of Christ had been the same in Africa for 2,000 years, we would have had exactly the same concepts of freedom, academic freedom, and so on, or Asia for that matter. But it so happened that it happened in the West, and these ideas of freedom and liberty and academic freedom have developed over several centuries. And we cannot just give them up like that. So academic freedom, my charter rights were violated, and I was defamed. And something like reputation is something that you build your reputation over a lifetime. And I was called a purveyor of misinformation, I was dangerous and so on. So those are the three parts of the lawsuit, and the reason I'm vigorously pursuing this lawsuit is really I'm not vindictive, but I want accountability from the system. I want accountability from the authorities, and importantly, these eternal truths, freedom, liberty, academic freedom even, is something that should be guarded for future generations, preserved for posterity. So these are the reasons I'm fighting the lawsuit.
This episode is brought to you by RockLink Investment Partners. The team at RockLink, as we all know them and love them, does not support a woke Marxist WEF-friendly cancel culture worldview. And they've created the Kokomo Fund. In light of bank accounts being seized and frozen during the Emergencies Act, or its former truer name, the War Measures Act, RockLink can help you move your investments overseas based on in the Cayman Islands, the world's number one offshore market for investment funds. Give the freedom lovers at RockLink a call, as many of our staff have, at 905-631-5462, or send them an email at info@rocklink.com. That's info@rocklink.com. It's interesting that the characteristic of guardianship, of standing watch, is a very important characteristic. We were encouraged to do that in scripture many, many times. We're supposed to keep watch of our own lives. We're supposed to keep watch of our community. We're supposed to keep watch for the coming of Christ, that we might be acting in a way that's honoring to Him. And yet so many people in this last 2 years, because of, I think maybe a lack of testing of that, a lack of experience in actually needing to be guardians, so many people saw standing up for those fundamental freedoms and rights as just a selfish act of behavior. How did that affect you? Did you find that there was struggle within the people around you, that you were being selfish, or was that an attack that was made? Was that the least of the attacks? You've got bigger fish to fry, or what?
You know, if you're being attacked for something as basic as informed consent, then obviously you're doing something right. So
that's
right. I have to say, by the grace of God, the attacks have not fazed me at all. I'm more determined than ever to have accountability in the system, and more determined than ever to have things like academic freedom, freedom of conscience, free speech. These things should be guarded. In our common law system, these are things that must be preserved for posterity, for my children and their children's children. So, yes, there have been all kinds of things said about me, but, I have to say, by the grace of God, they have not affected me at all.
That's wonderful news. Hopefully.
But they have undoubtedly affected my reputation. They have undoubtedly, caused me to have all kinds of negative repercussions because of what the authorities did to me. But this chatter which goes on in the background about people who are speaking up and so on, that's what I meant by that. But suddenly what the authorities did has affected not only me, but it has affected academic freedom, it's affected free speech, charter rights, all these things are at stake.
No, I agree with you. I am thankful that you gave clarity there, both to just the way that you've been feeling. And for me personally, this time has been a very resolving moment. You struggle with sometimes maybe feeling overly callous. At least I do. I struggle with being overly callous with the way that I am positioned and the way that people are talking about us. But you're 100% right that you can thrive as an individual, or you can deal with this gossip as an individual and with this chatter and not be bothered by it, because you have your identity in Christ and you have your reality based in your research and your process. But these types of things do have a major effect around you. And despite whether you're doing well or not, the fact that your name has been disparaged, I think of individuals who have called some of the doctors who have spoken up a blight on society. I'm thinking right now of our friend over at Western University, who was an ethics professor, and of course she's come on the program many times, and we appreciate all of the work that she's doing over there, and Dr. Julie Panessi, and you know that this has affected her life. These were this ended your career in some respects. What do you think about coming back from retirement? The lawsuit was won and your name was restored in that way?
So there's been great reputational damage by the authorities against me. And that has had its own repercussions in terms of me and my family and the way that they have characterized me as a purveyor of misinformation, disinformation, the way they've dismissed me, they've terminated my contract and so on. So undoubtedly that has had a great effect on my life in both practical terms and, you know, mental terms and my family. But the background chatter from the public of what they're saying about physicians generally, we have to keep speaking out. We have no choice. We have to keep fighting the tyranny. And if we don't, then the tyranny will triumph. So, I'm afraid me, and I think you, the wonderful person you were referring to is Julie Ponesi, people like us. We have no choice. We have to keep fighting the system. They may try and muzzle us. They may try and disparage us. They may try and insult us. The fact that they're doing that, it hasn't affected my determination to speak out.
So why don't you talk to us a little bit about some of the things you're seeing now that, you know, I think a lot of people are wondering, are we through the pandemic? When we have the prime minister coming forward and saying that, you know, are the freedoms that we so love can be attained if we have an 80 to 90% vaccination rate. I think there's this competing narrative in Canada. Are we going back in, or are we through this? What do you think is going to happen in the fall as we get back to the normal annual viral cycle? Have you heard any change in the opinions in the medical community that lockdowns were problematic, that the vaccines are causing damage and ineffective at the same time? Kind of give us your perspective on what you think is going to be happening as we come into the fall here.
Sure. Michael, I've started a Substack. It's called francischristian.substack.com. francischristian.substack.com. And my first essay in that Substack is called Why Freedom? And in it, I give the example of a bird in a cage. After a while, it has a certain affection for the hand that feeds it. It might even forget that it's in a cage, but it is still in a cage. And I think a lot of Canadians, a lot of the people, at least in Western countries, don't realize that they have been in this cage. Now, when the bird goes out to freedom and in its flight to freedom, yes, it is going into a world that is not necessarily completely predictable, but it is free. So a predictable, boring, caged life is something we are in danger of becoming used to. And once governments get power, the record shows that they don't easily give it up. Okay. And I think that this government, this prime minister, is not going to give up this tyrannical powers that he has accrued for himself illegally. Now, I have to say that as far as the summer has been concerned, most Canadians think that this is over. The tyranny is gone and things will go back to normal. I doubt it, because if there is some way in which governments can exert that control again, the same level of control, It'll happen. By the way, Canada is still an outlier in the way it allows people in or does not allow people in. There are all kinds of unscientific, nonsensical stuff going on. Like, we know the vaccines don't prevent transmission. They don't prevent infection. They're not safe. They're not effective. And yet, you know, Canadians, if you're not vaccinated, to come back home even, you have to go through quarantine, which makes absolutely no sense at all. I believe we are probably the only major nation that's going through this nonsensical thing. Why is that happening? Because the government wants to show that it's got power, that they can do it. Now, you have to realize that once the government has accrued power to itself, with that power comes this feeling of it's hubris and this false feeling of invincibility. I say it's false because, you know, you look at the Soviet Union, you look at every tyranny in history, it has a defined lifespan. No tyranny lasts forever, and every tyranny has a defined lifespan, including this tyranny. If tyrants would only look at history, they would fear and tremble at what happened to the tyrants. But unfortunately, tyrants are surrounded by this bubble of sycophants who actually feed them the kind of things they want to hear. And Trudeau is surrounded by those kind of people. But look at how the Soviet Union fell. When the Soviet Union fell, the things that the Soviet Union persecuted, things like the Bible, the great works of Russian literature, all that was still intact. So I have no doubt that this tyranny will try to reassert itself, but I have no doubt that the tyranny has a defined lifespan.
I think it's a good perspective to understand that by both the short and long term. I was more wondering specifically within the medical community. I think we always fall into this mindset where someone says, "Well, when the businesses stand up, that's when it'll be over," or when the church stands up, that's when it will be over. You know, that defined lifespan. At some point, someone stands up and brings it to an end. And I think for many people in Canada and the United States, they're waiting for the medical professionals to stand up and bring it to an end. You know, like we talked about it, like the medical profession has lost its soul. You know, you look at the authority and the trust for doctors, and it's at an all-time low. So I think everybody's going, well, yeah, like obviously Trudeau can't push this narrative if the medical community were to stand up and say something. So as we come into the fall, have you heard any different speak out of the medical community than what you've been hearing for the past 2 years? And I think that's kind of the indicator I was looking at. I appreciate the broad perspective, but I think people are really expecting, oh no, if Trudeau tries any shenanigans, finally the local health units will just say, no, we've had enough. As an insider, do you have any information for us on that?
Yes, I think I do. Forgive my allusion back to tyrannical regimes and tyranny, but I think to have some historical perspective in this is also good. In the Soviet Union, there were three different groups of populations. One was this group, you, me, a minority, who will defy the tyranny no matter what. In that group also is the samizdat press. The samizdat in Russian means the underground or the alternative underground press. At great risk to their own lives and in darkly lit apartments, through the night, people were churning out through, you know, half-broken typewriters, verses from the Bible, newsletters for the population, and these would be smuggled into the population. So that was a samizdat. So that resistance The Soviets did things like, you know, sent people to the Gulag, execute them, you know, imprison them and so on. That's a small minority. Then you have a big group who know that what's being told to them is all nonsense. It's completely ridiculous. But they say, oh, you know, what alternative do I have? I just have to go along with this. That's the biggest group. And then there's another group, which is unfortunately quite a sizable group, that feels that it is actually doing good. It's actually doing massive good, it thinks, by supporting the tyranny. There was an old Soviet saying, and that it went like this. To betray your neighbor was a patriotic duty, but the highest duty of all is to betray your own family. Now, unfortunately, doctors and nurses are now in this third group. They think they're helping. They think, and I'm talking about Canadian physicians and nurses too. They think actually that they're doing good. And so unless they decide to go back to old-fashioned medicine, doctor-patient relationship, putting the patient first, examining the data for yourself, looking at alternative views, looking at skeptical views about science, which is how science progresses, unless they do all these things, I don't think that waking up that you talk about is going to happen. And unfortunately, that's not yet happening.
Well, it saddens me to hear your perspective on that, but it's something that I too feel. I'm just not hearing any difference of opinion or behavior, you know, from the zealots in the medical community. You still have the lockdowners calling for further restrictions and lockdowns in order to protect the system. And then for those in the big majority group who know something's wrong and yet haven't acted, they're the ones saying, okay, we're just going back to business as normal. It's not normal, but we'll figure it out. And then they yet have not said, no, with this fall, if there is any problems, I'm going to be the one to stand in the gap. I'm going to be the one. And so that is my perspective too. And my concern is that the fall is going to continue, both because of the historical power grab that you talked about. It's clear that a government doesn't want to give up power easily, but also because of this mindset of the vast majority of people who are just following along with the narrative. Well, Dr. Christian, Francis, it's been a wonderful time of having you on with me. I feel that it's important for us to close with some scripture and to read the scripture in full that you referenced earlier, because I think that's the theme of this show. And the theme of this show is, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world yet to forfeit his soul? So I am going to read Mark chapter 9, verse 34 to verse 38, and read the entire quote of that passage. And I thank you for exhorting doctors and physicians and nurses and, of course, other men and women now is the time. But here is the context, and here is the scriptural reading of that passage. Talking about Jesus, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet to forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels." That is Mark chapter 9, verses 34 to 38. And folks, really, if you're a Christian, that is your call, to not just try to gain and save your life, but to take up your cross and follow Christ. And if you're not yet a Christian and you're just a freedom fighter who listens to this podcast, I think Francis and myself would exhort you to take up your cross and to follow Jesus, not just to follow freedom fighters, but to put your faith in Jesus Christ for your salvation and then for the wisdom of living. And it is another way of denying yourself and not just trying to save your life and save your own skin. So thank you for being on the show. It was a privilege to have you. And Francis, when the courts have done their part and you want to come back on and read from the court decisions and read from the transcripts and kind of walk us through what happened, I'd love to have you back on the show so people can hear an update. You did mention to our listeners where they can do more reading. You share that website again with us?
Absolutely. It's called Francis Christian, one word, Francis, FrancisChristian, one word, FrancisChristian.substack.com. FrancisChristian.substack.com. The latest essay I wrote there is called Why Medical Ethics? And I've got a number of essays on that website as well.
Well, I appreciate your time. Thank you for coming on the show, and Godspeed to your future work, to your poetry, and to defending all of these different areas that you're going after to defend. Thank you for doing that. Godspeed.
Thank you so much, Michael. Godspeed to you too, and it's a privilege to be on your show. God bless you.